A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's got a whole exercise for us this time, and it starts from the wrong end on purpose. Imagine an inventory management app. Add stock items, see a list, filter them, edit one, mark something out of stock. The front end is finished. Every screen, every component, every decision about what each page shows. And somehow, nobody built a back end. No database, no API, nothing. The job is to graft a back-end onto a front-end that's already sitting there and wire them together. He wants to know what pieces you build, in what order, what each piece is for, how a pile of flat files becomes a running system, and how you test the thing before the front-end ever connects. Python, Postgres, Django, or FastAPI, the general shape, not a framework tutorial.
So we're reverse engineering the back-end from the front-end. I love this. It's the exact opposite of how every tutorial works, and that's what makes it useful. You have to think about what each layer actually does instead of following a recipe. The front end already decided what data exists and what shape it's in, so you're not designing from scratch. You're reading the contract and building the machinery that fulfills it.
The front end as a living spec, which means the first thing you build isn't an endpoint.
It's the database. The database is the system of record. It's the one place where truth lives and everything else is a derivative. For this inventory app, you need an items table. Id, name, SQU, quantity, description, timestamps, and something like isactive for soft deletes. Maybe a categories table if the front end shows categories. The database enforces constraints at the row level that no amount of careful application code can guarantee. Quantity can't be negative. SQU must be unique. Those constraints protect your data even when buggy code tries to write garbage. If the front end sends a negative quantity, the database rejects it at the boundary. That's not a bug in the API. That's the database doing its job.
So you start with a schema that mirrors what the front end already expects to display. The front end shows a SKU field, so the database has a SKU column. The front end shows quantity. The database stores quantity. You're not designing, you're transcribing.
Transcribing with teeth. The front end might show a quantity of zero as out of stock, but the database is the thing that refuses to let that quantity go below zero in the first place. That distinction matters. The front end is presentation. The database is enforcement. Think of it like a bank. The ATM screen shows your balance formatted with a dollar sign and commas. That's the front end. But the ledger at the bank's mainframe is the database. The ATM can display whatever it wants. The ledger is what actually says whether you can withdraw that money. If the ATM shows $500, but the ledger says you've got $12, the ledger wins every time. The database is the ledger.
And then you need something that talks to it.
The ORM. Django's ORM in this case. This is the part where most front-end developers have seen the syntax but haven't seen what it actually does. You write item.objects.filter and you get back what looks like results. It's not results. A query set is a specification of a query that hasn't run yet. The ORM is aggressively lazy. It builds up an internal SQL query object as you chain methods, and it only compiles and executes that SQL when you actually consume it. Iterate over it, call count on it, slice it. That's when the database round trip happens.
So item.objects.filter quantity equals 0.order by minus updated at slice 10. That whole chain is one query.
One query, where, order by limit, all in a single SQL statement, not four round trips. And the way it works under the hood is elegant. Each filter or exclude clones the query set and adds to an internal SQL.query object. When you finally consume it, the SQLC compiler walks that object and translates it into database-specific SQL. Different dialects for PostgreSQL versus SQLite, and fires it off through the database connection. The Python you wrote never touched a database row until that moment.
Which means code that looks like it makes one query might make 400. That's the trap. Heman, the N plus one problem. you iterate over a list of items, and inside the loop you access item.category.name. Looks innocent. But if you didn't pre-fetch the category relationship, the ORM issues a new query for every single item to fetch its category. A page showing 50 items just made 51 queries instead of one. The Python syntax is identical either way. The difference is whether you understood what the ORM was actually doing. Let's make that concrete. You've got a warehouse dashboard showing a table of inventory items, and each row shows the item name, the quantity, and the category it belongs to. 50 rows on the page. The naive code does item.objects, all, then loops through and prints item.category.name for each one. The first query gets all 50 items. Then for item 1, it queries the category table. Item 2, another query. Item 3, another. By the time the page renders, you've hit the database 51 times. The user sees a table that took 2 seconds to load, and the database logs are full of identical select statements.
And the fix is one line. item.objects.selectrelatedcategory.all. That tells the ORM to do a join in the first query and fetch the category data alongside the item data. One query, 50 rows, all the category names already loaded. The Python code in the loop doesn't change at all. The difference is invisible from the syntax, which is why it's so dangerous. You can write perfectly functional code that works great with 10 items in development and absolutely craters with 10,000 in production.
So the ORM is a bridge, but it's a bridge with a trap door. Step on the wrong plank and you're falling into a query storm.
And the only way to know you've stepped on is to look at the SQL that actually executes. Django has a connection.queries list you can inspect, or you use the Django debug toolbar. But the point is, the abstraction leaks, and it's supposed to. The ORM doesn't hide SQL from you. It delays SQL until you need it, and then it hands you exactly what you asked for, including the mistakes.
So we've got the database and the ORM. Next is the thing the front end actually talks to.
The API layer. Django REST framework views and serializers. This is the contract. The front end sends HTTP requests. GET P requests GET /IPI/IPI/items with a JSON body. The API receives those, validates the input, calls the ORM, and returns JSON. The serializer is the translator. It converts between Python model instances and JSON, and it defines which fields are exposed, what types they are, and what validation rules apply. The front end sends a POST with a name and a quantity. The serializer checks that quantity is an integer, that the name isn't blank, that the SQ isn't a duplicate. If validation fails, the API returns a 400 with error details, and the database never sees the request.
The browser has no idea the database exists. It only ever talks to the API. That line from the Express walkthrough, it's the thing that clicks for people.
And it's worth sitting with that for a second because it's the answer to where do front-end and back-end actually meet. They meet at the HTTP request. The front-end sends JSON over the wire to a URL. The back-end's router matches that URL to a view function. The view deserializes the request body, calls the ORM, which compiles SQL and sends it to the database over a separate socket. The response comes back, database to ORM to serializer to view to HTTP response to front end. The front end never sees a database connection string, never sees a table name, never sees SQL. It sees JSON.
Let's trace a single post. Front end sends a JSON body with name, SQ, quantity to post /API/items. What actually happens?
The request hits the Django router, which matches the URL pattern to a view. The view hands the request body to the item serializer. The serializer checks every field. Is quantity an integer above zero? Is the SKU in the right format? Is the name present? If it passes, the serializer calls save, which calls create on the query set, which builds an INSERTSQL statement, which the SQL compiler translates to Postgres-specific SQL, which executes against the database connection. The database inserts the row, returns the new id, the ORM hydrates a model instance, the serializer converts it back to JSON, and the view returns an HTTP 21 with that JSON body. The front end gets back exactly what it sent, plus the id and timestamps the database generated.
Every step is a translation. JSON to Python dict, Python dict to model instance to SQL, SQL to row, row back to model back to JSON.
And every translation is a place where assumptions can diverge. The front end sends a SKU with dashes, ABC-123-XYZ. The serializer accepts it because it's a string. The database stores it because the column is varchar. Everything works. Then 6 months later, someone builds a search feature that strips dashes on display, and now the SKU in the database doesn't match the SKU in the search index, and nobody knows why. That's not a bug you catch by looking at the front end. The front end proved the app worked, you could add items, see them in a list, but it didn't prove the data model was consistent.
That sounds like a war story, not a hypothetical.
It has the texture of one, but we'll get to that. First, I want to sit with the thing Daniel said he's never heard properly explained, the flat files to running system transition. You open the project in VS Code, and it's text. You type pythonmanage.pyrunserver, and suddenly it's alive. What actually happened?
The operating system created a process
with a unique PID and a slice of virtual memory carved out just for it. The Python interpreter loads into that space and starts executing manage.py. Django bootstraps, reads settings.py, iterates through inestalled_apps, imports every model, connects signals, runs system checks. If there's a syntax error in a model file or a broken import, the process dies right here. This is why it worked 5 minutes ago, usually fails at startup. The error was always there. The process just hadn't tried to load that file yet.
Then it binds to a port.
The critical moment. Django creates a TCP socket and asks the OS for permission to bind to an address and port, usually 127.0.0.1:8000. The OS says yes. From that instant, the OS knows that any traffic arriving at port 8000 belongs to this Python process. The server enters an event loop, sitting in a low CPU idle state, waiting for a network interrupt. It's doing nothing. It's waiting to be poked.
And the database connection?
Lazy. Not opened at startup. The ORM doesn't connect to Postgres until the first query actually executes. When something finally calls item.objects.all and consumes the query set, the ORM pulls a connection from the pool or creates one, sends the compiled SQL over a separate socket to Postgres, and waits for results. So, the full transition is text files to Python process in memory. Process binds a socket to a port. Event loop waits for HTTP requests. Lazy database connection established on first query. The files never stop being files. The process is what makes them dynamic.
Which means if you kill the process, you're back to flat files. Nothing persists except what's in the database.
That's the whole architecture in one sentence. The database is the only thing that survives a restart. The process is ephemeral. The files are just the recipe. It's like a kitchen. The recipe card is the flat file. It describes what to do, but it can't feed anyone by itself. The chef is the running process. They read the recipe and actually do the work. The pantry is the database. It's where the ingredients live, and it persists after the kitchen closes. Kill the chef, the recipe is still there, the pantry is still stocked, but nobody's cooking. Start a new chef. They pick up the same recipe, pull from the same pantry, and the kitchen is back in business.
We've got a running system. How do you know it works before a front end connects to it?
Three layers. Unit tests verify individual functions in isolation. Does the serializer reject a negative quantity? Does the price calculation apply discounts correctly? They're fast, they're narrow, and they catch logic errors before anything else runs. Integration tests are the highest value investment for APIs. You spin up a real test database. Test Containers runs a disposable Postgres in Docker, about 5 to 10 seconds of startup once in before all, not per test, and you make actual HTTP requests to your endpoints. You assert status codes, response bodies, and database state. You test the real HTTP contract, real authentication, real database interactions. No mocks. Contract tests verify your API matches its open API spec. You can test every endpoint, every error case, every auth scenario, without a front end ever being involved.
Then you connect the front end and it proves something the tests didn't.
Several things. It proves core's headers are correct. The browser won't let the front end talk to the API otherwise. It proves the JSON shapes actually match what the front end components expect. pagination parameters line up, error messages display properly, but the deeper thing is that in-memory databases don't behave identically to production, Postgres. Indexes, constraints, and query planner behavior differ. You can have tests that pass and code that fails in production because the test database optimized a query differently. A working front end also proves latency is acceptable. A test might pass in 50 millisecods, but the real user experience might be 2 seconds because of network overhead, database connection pool saturation, or slow queries that only appear under real load patterns.
Connection pool saturation. A pool capped at 10 connections. 100 users hit the API simultaneously. The first 10 grab connections and the rest wait.
Your test never simulated that because you ran them sequentially. The front end won't tell you why it's slow, either. It'll just be slow. But it proves the slowness exists. The tension is between does it work and does it work correctly under all conditions. The front end proves the first. Tests prove the second. You need both.
The front end is the final sanity check that the whole stack actually talks to itself. But it's a blunt instrument. It tells you something is wrong.
That's the handoff. You build the database first because it's the system of record. You build the ORM next because it's the bridge between your code and the database. And you understand it's lazy, so you don't write N+1 queries by accident. You build the API on top because it's the contract the front end talks to. You test at every layer, and then you connect the front end and discover which of your assumptions were wrong.
The SKU with dashes. That was me. Not me personally. I was the back-end guy they brought in after the fact. Startup, about 2002. The CEO hired a designer and 2 React developers. They spent 6 months building this inventory app. Beautiful thing. Animated transitions. Drag and drop. Nobody asked where the data lived. I got hired, sat down with the front-end code, and the SKU field had a format mask hard-coded in the component. 3 letters, dash, 3 numbers, dash, 3 letters. Auto-formatted as you typed. Nobody wrote that down anywhere. It was just what the text input did. I built the database with a plain varchar column. The API accepted any string. Front-end sent SKUs with dashes. Database stored them with dashes. Everything looked fine. Items appeared in the list. Search worked. 6 months later, someone noticed the search feature was returning duplicates. The front end was stripping dashes for display, but the database still had them. So searching for ABC123 found nothing, because the database had ABC-123-XYZ. The front end proved the app worked. You could add items. You could see them. It didn't prove the data model was consistent. That's the silent corruption. 2 representations of the same piece of data that drifted apart because an assumption lived in a React component and never made it to a schema. Cost about 3 weeks to fix, data migration, front-end patch, search index rebuild. I still think about that dash.
The format mask is the perfect example. It's not a bug. It's a design decision that was invisible to everyone except the person who wrote the component. And it silently shaped the entire data model. Every SKU in the database has dashes, because one front-end developer thought SKUs should be formatted nicely.
The database didn't care. Varchar takes anything. The serializer didn't care. It's a string. The only thing that cared was the search feature, 6 months later, when the mismatch finally surfaced.
That's the thing tests catch that a front-end never will. Not the dash itself. The assumption that the dash was part of the data rather than part of the display. An integration test that inserted a SKU without dashes and then searched for it'd have failed. But nobody wrote that test because nobody knew the assumption existed.
The front-end developers didn't think of it as an assumption. It was just how the input worked. Type a SKU, see dashes. They'd built the whole UI around that format. The search box, the filter dropdowns, the CSV export, all of it assumed dashes. I was the first person who looked at the database and thought, wait, is the dash data or presentation? By then, we had 4,000 SKUs in production.
4,000 rows with an invisible formatting decision baked into the primary identifier.
The migration script that stripped the dashes ran for 40 minutes. I watched it the whole time.
That brings us to something the research turned up that I haven't seen written about anywhere. This exercise. Grafting a backend onto a finished front end doesn't appear to have a single tutorial, article, or guide devoted to it. Searched everywhere. The closest things are full-stack tutorials that build both sides simultaneously. The pedagogical approach Daniel described, reverse engineering. The back end from the front end. It's a gap in the literature. Which is strange, because it's probably the fastest way to teach someone what each layer actually does.
Most tutorials build both sides at once, so the assumptions are made simultaneously and never surface. You decide the SKU format while you're designing the database schema, so the question never arises. The reverse engineering exercise forces those assumptions into the open, because the front end already made them, and you have to discover them. It's like being handed a finished building and told to design the plumbing. You can't say, well, the bathroom should be over here. They're already tiled and the toilets are installed. You have to figure out where the pipes must run based on where the fixtures already are.
As front-end tooling gets more sophisticated, Next.js, Remix, server components, the boundary between front-end and back-end is blurring. You can write a server action that queries the database directly from a React component. The line is fuzzier than it's ever been, which makes understanding where the line actually is more important, not less. If you don't know what the ORM is doing, server components just mean you're writing N+1 queries closer to the user.
The abstraction is thinner, so the trapdoor is closer to your feet.
The cutting room floor detail I wanted to land, the Django development server is single-threaded by design. Fine for local development, one request at a time, you see exactly what's happening. In production, you swap it for Gunicorn or UWSGI with multiple worker processes. But that single-threadedness is actually a feature for learning. It forces you to notice when a request is slow, because the next request has to wait. You can't hide performance problems behind concurrency. It's the difference between a one-lane bridge and a highway. On the highway, a slow truck doesn't block traffic. Everyone goes around. On the one-lane bridge, everyone lines up behind the truck, and you immediately know something's wrong.
The open question I keep coming back to is, why nobody's written this up? The reverse engineering approach is the clearest way to teach back-end architecture to front-end developers. You start from what they already understand. The UI, the data shapes, the user flows, and you work backward through the layers until you hit the database. Every layer answers the question. What does the layer above me need, and how do I provide it? Maybe it's because the people who know the full stack well enough to write that tutorial don't remember what it was like to only know the front end.
Or they remember, but they built the back end first and can't imagine doing it the other way. Either way, the gap is real. Somebody should write it.
This has been my Weird Props. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps more than you'd think. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird props, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.